Hello and welcome to the Eco Chamber, brought to you by the team from the environmental policy magazine, The ENDS Report. In this specially extended episode, we'll examine why the government has decided to report on just 7 out of 24 nature indicators this year, why our normally rainy little island is hurtling towards a major drought, and why things are looking up for the country's beavers. And then we have a real treat for you in the form of an interview with punk legend Fergal Sharkey, who has some juicy observations about the way the water sector is managed and regulated. Following that, Simon Pickstone and Alice Fillon will be here to fill you in on the EU's plans to monitor environmental progress through a raft of green indicators, ranging from nitrates in groundwater to the share of buses and trains in transport. So, without further ado, let's enter the Eco Chamber. I'm Rachel Savage, and today I'm here with Pippa Neal and Tess Colley, and we're going to look at the big green news of the fortnight. Our first story is about DEFRA's disappearing biodiversity indicators. The government normally reports on 24 indicators ranging from the condition of important birds, pollinators, threatened species, habitats and so on, to air, marine and water pollution, to climate change and funding for biodiversity and things like that. They're established to help the country report on its progress towards meeting the global 2020 biodiversity targets that were set in Aichi in Japan in 2010 as part of the Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD for short, to which the UK is a signatory. So a rather enormous side note to this is that the UK failed to meet nearly all of those targets. Well, the government reckons it failed 14, but the RSPB said it failed 17, and DEFRA disputes that, but whatever it is, it's not a good picture. So new targets are now being put together for 2020, and they're going to be revealed at the CBD COP15 in Canada in December. Anyway, back to these indicators. So it's emerged that DEFRA had decided this year it's only going to report on 7 of them rather than 24. So leaving out many of the, leaving out the progress or otherwise on problematic issues like water pollution, threatened habitats, birds, and so on. DEFRA did ask some NGOs about what it thought about ditching the whole lot for 2022 and found them unimpressed. 7 seems to be a compromise, but a lot of green groups had no idea that DEFRA planned to dump any of them at all. But Tess, you flagged up earlier that DEFRA was mulling this a while back. So what reason have DEFRA given for leaving out all of these indicators?
The reason they're giving now is that they're linking it to this, the COP15 biodiversity summit that you just talked about, saying that in order to, ensure that new targets and new data, new indicator data matches whatever targets are agreed there, they need to hold back on reporting biodiversity targets this year, in order to do that. That's the reason that's been given. And it was trailed a while ago when the last sets were published, set of biodiversity indicators were published. But at that time they were saying, oh, we might not report at all, which the NGOs didn't like at all, as you can imagine, and they've consulted. And now we've got to where we are, but this isn't exactly what the NGOs were asking for either.
Well, it seems that I know that they definitely contacted Wildlife and Countryside Link to ask them what they thought about it, and they weren't impressed at all. But a lot of the NGOs that, they seem to have now come out and not appeared to have known anything about it at all and just be downright shocked. So it can't be much of a consultation. What have they been saying?
Well, yeah, as you say, there's been quite a range. The RSPB, they've come out saying they're disappointed in DEFRA, that they will not be reporting on all environmental indicators this year, including the one for wild birds, which the RSPB itself feeds into. They're clearly not very happy. The Rivers Trust chief exec, he said that consistent, reliable data sets are fundamental to the success of our collective endeavour to restore ecosystems to good health. You already mentioned the chief executive of Wildlife and Countryside Link. He really wasn't happy. He said that these aren't some academic exercise. They're measuring these things like air, water, habitats, wildlife. They're fundamental to our country. And the fact this was just done, not even a press release, not even a full debate in the Commons. He pointed out, it's not great. It's pretty much outright whitewash was another phrase used. It's across the board. The NGOs are really not happy about it at all.
I think for their part, DEFRA said to me, because I've been asking them for their reason. Obviously, it's the reason that you gave earlier, Tess, about having to pause while they you know, prepare for potential new targets. But it's, they've said to me, so this is the following, this is their quote. They said, a thorough review of our biodiversity indicator data is being conducted ahead of the vitally important Convention of Biological Diversity. In the interim period, only key indicators are being published. This will ensure future policy is based on best available data. But how publishing less information equates to ensuring best available data remains a little bit unclear.
Yeah, I would say I did see a DEFRA special advisor tweet. I don't know if you saw it in relation to this story.
No.
But she added that she said about it was about focusing resource on a comprehensive review so they're ready for CBD framework. And I thought bringing in the resourcing of it was a new thing that hadn't been said before.
Yeah. But, well, that's interesting. Yeah. But in another breath, I said, they won't, well, you know, we'll report them all again in 2023 and no data will be lost. So if no data is going to be lost, just report the whole lot. Mm-hmm. Maybe delay them a couple of months. But, you know, so many people are reliant on these, for, you know, for planning.
Yeah.
It seems a little bit nuts. Right, let's move on to our next story, which, unless you've been living in the Svalbard seed vault for the last few weeks, you'll be quite familiar with. No, it's not about England's rare and lovely victory in the Euros. That would be far too uplifting for the Eco Chamber, obviously. This is about the looming drought. So to the surprise of no one, the climate crisis is upon us and we are not prepared for it, despite repeated warning from experts, including the government's own advisors, the Climate Change Committee, who must feel like they're collectively banging their heads on walls and have been doing so for years. But now, unless we experience a lot of rain, and very soon, we can expect to experience a drought and restrictions in water use. Pippa, can you tell us a little bit about how we've gotten to this position?
Yeah, so obviously a couple of weeks ago, was it last week now, there was, you know, record temperatures across the UK with temperatures above 40 degrees. And I saw the Met Office have said that it's been the driest July in England since 1911, with about 24% of the amount of rain that would normally be expected. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. And I mean, when you go outside, you can just automatically see the dryness, like in the grass, or seeing kind of trees falling from leaves. So it's kind of an unexpected picture of what's going on.
Yeah. And then there was a briefing from DEFRA the other day, and they were talking about the stages of drought. So there are three. There's prolonged dry weather status. That's where we are at the moment. And then there's drought, and then there's severe drought, where we're all going to be sort of lining up in standpipes in the street. And then there's a recovery phase, apparently, which takes quite a long time to sort of get back to normal from. So obviously, you know, as Pippa described, there have been lots of issues so far related to the dry weather. But what have the regulators been doing, Tess? Have they been out in action trying to sort of respond to environmental issues?
Well, there's been a few things going on. One thing that the Environment Agency in Yorkshire has done is actually they've already put in an application for a drought order in order to help the Holmes Stiles Reservoir in Yorkshire to stop it from running dry. And that would mean the EA could then ask Yorkshire Water to slow the flow of water leaving the reservoir. That's not been kind of granted yet, but that could be coming down the line. Elsewhere, things they've actually already done, and then the extreme weather we had, they've kind of deployed aeration pumps. They seek to put oxygen back into the water, basically, because with all the heat, the water evaporating, there's less oxygen in the water, which is a problem, obviously, for fish and other wildlife. And to that kind of similar end, the NRW Natural Resources Wales released extra water into the River Wye and the River Dee in a similar thing to stop it from running dry.
Oh, is that the River Wye that they said there's no problem with?
Everything's fine on the Y.
Sure.
But yeah, they more than doubled the flow entering the River Dee.
Right.
And well, I should say they didn't directly release the water into the Y, they released it into a tributary, yes, that feeds the Y. But yeah, and we've seen lots of water scarcity notices going out in Scotland from SEPA. Obviously they didn't get the same levels of heat we got further down south, but it's across Great Britain.
I saw that Southern Water has submitted a drought permit as well. So that means, controversially, that it'd be able to take more water from the River Test, which I think is a chalk stream and quite a valuable salmon river, to keep supplying customers. And would let, you know, also I think it would get the public to try and reduce their water use as well. But that's not going to, that hasn't gone down with angling groups and green groups. I imagine will soon we get a little bit cross with that as well, because being such an important salmon river and salmon populations crashing, that's not going to That's not going to make them happy.
No, of course not. And Southern Water is probably just the first out the blocks.
Definitely.
Thames Water are already making noises saying that there's probably one coming down the line. This is despite, you know, the Southern Water announced its hosepipe ban the day after the kind of the EA said nowhere is officially in drought yet. Nobody panic.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, the next day Southern Water announced a hosepipe ban. So I think, yeah, they don't want to panic people, but it's extremely dry outside.
Yeah. And in what other ways has the heat wave been and the drought been affecting people in the environment, Pippa?
So there's been reports of wildfires across the country, with 41 homes, I think is the latest number, being destroyed in London, with Sadiq Khan saying that the firefighters had their busiest 24 hours since the Second World War. There's also been nature reserves that have been lost to fires, with over 100 acres destroyed in Norfolk. And England and Wales have recorded more than 440 wildfires so far this year, up from 247 in all of 2021. So considering we're only just at the start of August, it's pretty bad situation.
It's frightening. We're going the way of the continent, aren't we, with all these wildfires? The National Infrastructure Commission as well has come out and said that we need a national hosepipe ban now to avoid more painful measures later, which I think makes a lot of sense. And they painted the picture of us queuing for water from the back of lorries, that, you know, if we don't, you know, get grip on this sooner. And it kind of speaks to the whole problem of not having planned in advance, knowing this is coming, knowing the population is growing and the climate crisis is looming or here. But we still don't have, you know, significant new water sources or supply or storage infrastructure in place to sort of head it all off, even though you've been talking about it for decades. So I think that's something that we've talked about before on the End Report in terms of the jaws of death or day zero, you know, these days when these moments when cities are going to run out of water in terms of demand outstripping supply. So, you know, go back to look on our other podcasts of that or have a look on endreport.com because we've written a great deal on that and more will definitely come. So maybe we could all do a rain dance or something like that to get those clouds gathering to deliver the massively above average rainfall that we need, because we're nothing if not scientific here on the Eco Chamber. Our final story is much more cheerful and should go a little way to help us with our water problems. It's about the protections that are in the pipeline to protect beavers that are being released mainly into enclosures at the moment around the UK. We've talked about this before on the Eco Chamber, but the news is now that, all being well, it could become an offence to harm them without a licence. Pippa, what's all this about?
So by listing beavers under Schedule 2 of the Conservation of Habitats and Species Regulation, it makes it an offence to deliberately capture, kill, disturb or injure beavers or damage their breeding sites or resting places without holding the appropriate licence. And so it kind of makes beavers that have been extinct in the wild for around 400 years a native species in the UK or in England, which therefore gives them new protections. But the announcements followed a period of confusion where it kind of seemed that DEFRA was going to pull the plug on these provisions, with sources kind of alluding to the fact that it was due to lobbying from the NFU, which, you know, isn't surprising. And given their statement, which said it was unacceptable that the government had pushed through this legislation before summer recess with no details of a management plan. So there's been kind of a lot of controversy around this, but regardless of that, it's kind of a great move and will really help in the reintroduction programmes and, as Rachel said, in helping kind of the broader picture of improving the water quality across the country.
So recently you've been to see some beavers, haven't you? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I went last week to the Hatchmere Nature Reserve, which sits on the edge of Delamere Forest in Cheshire. So Hatchmere Nature Reserve is a SSSI, but due to intensive farming nearby and also road pollution, the river that runs through and the mere at the bottom of the nature reserve has got high levels of pollution from nutrients and phosphates in the water. So the Cheshire Wildlife Trust started a programme about a year ago now, introducing beavers into the area in order to kind of create a wetland and rewild the whole nature reserve. And it was amazing to see just in 12 months what an impact just these two beavers have had on the whole area. So they'd built a 45-foot dam across, which had enabled the water flow to completely change, creating a wetland with the person I met from the Wildlife Trust explaining that they'd got, you know, high levels of fish stocks, they'd got kingfishers on the sites that they'd never had before, and the pollution from the farming and agriculture nearby is kind of more dispersed and less in the specific protected area. So it was really amazing to see the changes that these two beavers had had, which, if kind of it was done, if it was man-made changes, would cost millions and would require heavy machinery, whereas instead this kind of natural solution is amazing. And, you know, the spokesperson I met was really happy about this new legislation, kind of showing it's definitely a step in the right direction in encouraging these schemes, these reintroductions, to happen not just in enclosures but in the wild, where beavers will just be able to kind of respond naturally. And they also showed, in relation to what we were talking about earlier with the drought, the person I met explained that they used a drone and kind of compared where the beavers have been, and you could just see how kind of wet the whole area was in comparison to the fields and the agriculture land nearby, which was completely dry. So as kind of climate change worsens and we start to see more impacts of high heat waves and things, these kind of reintroduction programs can be really, really beneficial.
Mm. Everyone's going to want a beaver in their garden to keep their lawns nice, yes. and green.
Yeah.
We saw the photo. This is not good for podcasting, but you can. Pippa is going to be writing a few pieces about this, and you'll be able to see the photographs on Energy Report when she's written them. But and I shouldn't really be describing photographs, but they're amazing. The size of these dams and the amount of water that's collected behind them, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, she's a architect, aren't they?
Yeah, completely blown away by them. So that's something for everyone to look forward to when you've written those pieces. Pippa, thank you for that. That's it, I think. That's what a lovely way to end. Wouldn't it be lovely if it became a regular sight on all of our rivers? I think that would be a nice place for us to end up. But we have ended up here. It brings us to the end of the Big Green News section. Thank you, Pippa. Thank you, Tess. We'll be back in a fortnight's time. But if you can't wait that long, you can go to energyreport.com for lots more on all of these issues. Next up is our deep dive section, and this week we have something very special for you. I've been speaking to music legend Fergal Sharkey. Now, some of you know him from his days as the Undertones frontman when he had hits with songs like Teenage Kicks and My Perfect Cousin. Others may remember him for his solo career, notably A Good Heart, which went to number one in 1985 in a number of countries, including the UK. Or maybe you know him from his work behind the scenes within the music industry that earned him an OBE. Well, we at the Eco Chamber know him for all of these achievements, but what we're interested in Fergal for is his game-changing intervention in the sorry state of England's rivers. I spoke to him last week about the mess we find ourselves in. So, absolutely delighted to have Fergal Sharkey here with us in the Eco Chamber. I've been describing you as a musician turned campaigner, but I don't think that really covers it. How would you describe yourself?
I don't. That's the kind of weird thing. Musician I can kind of live with. It's the campaigner thing I find slightly unsettling, because that's clearly not anything I'd ever planned to do, and I don't see myself as a campaigner. I think you and I maybe have discussed this before. I stumbled into this purely by accident. I've described it many times in the past now that my introduction to this was via chalk streams and the Amal Magna fishery and all that good stuff. My instincts and my curiosity, and as we're on a podcast and not on national telly, my bullshit detector went off very, very quickly, very early on in the process. And to this day, it's still peaked in the red, bending the needle furiously, and it showed no signs several years later of deflecting to the left and releasing the pressure any way whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. So it was via the fishery, when you've been fishing, that you saw all this.
Your listeners that aren't aware, I'm chairman of one of the oldest fly fishing clubs in the country. When I became chairman, I, as part of my introduction, became aware there had been a 15-year-old discussion going on with the Environment Agency and Thames Water about lack of water. And I quickly began to realise that for 15 years, a bunch of grown-ups had been sitting in meetings, writing reports, doing endless studies, digging boreholes into aquifers, creating mathematical models of the aquifer of the under Hertfordshire, fish surveys, invertebrate surveys, mammal surveys, water vole surveys, and on and on, and none of it without resolution. As it turned out, the Environment Agency in Thames Water had hired a consultancy company called Halcro at the time, back in 2003, who had actually told everybody what the problem was, how to resolve it, and if they made some simple adjustments, the whole thing would resolve and fix itself within hours. None of that ever happened, and 15 years later, 2.5 miles of chalk stream in Hertfordshire was stagnating, suffering from eutrophication, turning into 2.5 mile long stagnant pond.
Wow. And what were the quick fixes that it had suggested?
It transpired that back in the September of 1997, the Environment Agency Flood Defence had made some adjustments to the flood defence control system, which started diverting water away from the river and sending it off on a jolly down the flood system all the time. Nothing to do with floods whatsoever, and in fact was diverting the water away from the river. There you go. It was that complicated.
Right. And is that particular problem fixed now?
Oh, I'm happy to say it'll come as no surprise that thanks to the local team in particular, there is a now flow gauges at both the inlet into the Emma Magna fishery and at the bottom of the fishery. The local team do a fantastic job, and the Environment Agency in Hertfordshire now work especially hard to make sure every drop of available water is going down the river through the Emma Magna fishery. It's worked out to the fish's satisfaction. The fish seem to be very happy about the whole thing.
So the state of, obviously that's one good outcome that you don't really hear a great deal about, but overall the system, the river systems, they're all still in a mess. They're all only 14% are in good ecological health.
Well, as I normally describe it to people, the Amwa Magna is not exclusively, but as you can imagine, it is mostly comprised of 60 old men who just want to go fly fishing. We don't want to start taking legal battles and working with Fish Legal and taking the Environment Agency to the High Court. We just want to turn up on the river for a couple of hours, catch a couple of trout, and go home and lead quiet lives in North London and the surrounding countryside. So and I've described this to several senior people now in the Environment Agency. I've began to think, why on earth did 60 old men and women have to take you guys to the doors of the High Court? And that made me curious, and that gave me a niche. And to my deep regret, I foolishly and stupidly scratched that itch. And I suspect, like you, Rachel Salvage, every time I scratch that itch, I just end up with an even bigger itch than I had before.
Yeah, that does happen.
And every day for the 3 years now, or whatever it is that I got myself into this, every day, if not every week, there's just another layer of an onion gets peeled, another layer of an onion gets exposed, and I just end up with a bigger itch. And the whole thing is clearly a shocking indictment to the political oversight of the water industry for 30 years, a complete and utter failure, systematic failure, institutional failure of both regulators, Ofwat and the EA, and the industry itself completely gaming the system to its own advantage and its own benefit.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's not a criticism. My applause to the companies. They saw a vacuum, they saw an opportunity, they went for it, and by God, if they got away with it. Well done them. The problem is, they've now, if the recent figures I've seen are to be believed, they've now benefited to the tune of about £72 billion worth of interest payments and dividends, and all of that is bill payers' money, that's £72 billion, and the real debt of that is not only being carried by bill payers, but by the environment. That's the one that's really picking up the cost of their profitability.
Yeah. I mean, but the mind boggles. I mean, surely nobody sets out to pollute rivers and annihilate habitats and fish populations. I mean, is it just, you know, what's the driving force here?
It's the bit where for me, the main fundamental premise of where the regulation began to fail. Is that clearly you end up, in the case of Ofwat, and I'm probably going to get quite philosophical for this time of the morning.
Good,
That's unlike you, Sister Rachel. So I apologise in advance. you have a an economics regulator in the shape of Ofwat, who, based on some kind of sixth form interpretation of the Chicago School of Economics, was trying to recreate on paper what they thought was the kind of pricing mechanism that an open competitive market for the supply of water might provide to the consumer. So they do this completely factious paper exercise every 5 years, and Ofwat come up with this theoretical model, and they decide that's what the price of water would be to the consumer in a fully formed, deregulated, unrestricted, competitive commercial market. It's nonsense, and it was nonsense from day one. And there's one of the main drivers why it's nonsense. It overlooks what actually drives and motivates those companies.
Yeah.
And is what is becoming increasingly clearer, and the evidence is now becoming increasingly available, particularly over the last 12 months. What's been driving those companies is dividends, the gearing, levels of gearing on the balance sheets, the amount of money they can tax free offshore in terms of interest payments, and the amount of bonuses and salaries being paid to the chief executives. So at that point, you have a chief executive asking a question, hypothetically, do I spend that £1 million on this sewage pump that I know will fix this problem for another 30 years? Or do I spend £500,000 on that pump that'll fix it for 10 years? At that point, I'm gone anyway. I've taken the extra £500,000 I've just saved. I've been awarded 50 grand of that by my bosses because I saved them £500,000. And at that point, I'm gone anyway with an extra 50 grand in my bonus. Well, guess what happens? So the truth is, it was desperately naive on the part of the regulators. And the EA themselves got them trapped into this whole notion of what's referred to as reputational incentives. The notion being, oh, if we criticize these company name and shame them in public, it will in some way do something to incentivize them to do the right thing. Oh, how we laughed. That's what you're dealing with. Cynical, blatant commercial greed and profiteering.
Yeah. So I guess you're laying a lot of the blame here off Watt's door for not letting them, I mean, for what you described, but also they try to cap what they can pay so water bills don't get too high. But that seems like, what do you think about that? I think I've heard water companies saying, we'd like to spend more, but we're not allowed to spend, we're only allowed to spend up to this sort of capped amount.
I'll remind the water companies that they do have a right to appeal.
Right.
Ofwat's determinations every 5 years, the final determination, if the water companies don't agree with it, they can appeal it. And ironically enough, if I remember, there was, four or five of the companies this year appealed the Ofwat decisions to the CMA, and one of them, for example, Anglian Water, and was the appeal about how much they were being allowed to charge their customers for X, Y, or Z. No, the real grounds for the appeal was the cost of borrowing and the levels of interest that Ofwat had allowed them to accommodate them to pay back to their shareholders and back to the people whose bonds they're carrying on their balance sheet. So they found a way to appeal it when it was involving the amount of interest they could pay back to their debtors. But how many times do you think water companies have appealed over the amount of money they've been allocated to the environment over the last 30 years?
Not often.
There you go. Funny old game, isn't it?
Yeah. So did you see the Environment Agency's report from 22nd of July showing that the sector's performances are worst in at least a decade? Environmental performance, I should say.
I did. And I was very taken in that on many levels, I actually felt genuinely really conflicted about the whole thing. There's a curious thing. I think Alistair Campbell actually put one side of the argument for me very well. As a government document, it's an astonishing piece of work. Blunt, brutal appraisal of what's going on, and every government should adopt the same approach as quickly and rapidly as possible. And that's from Alistair Campbell. It's an astonishing document. Clearly, the other side of it is, well done, Emma Howard Board. You could have said that 13 years ago or at any point during the last 13 years that you've been sitting on the board.
Mm.
There is so many levels to that single report. As you've indicated, you can take it on a purely superficial level. that the approach to regulation and the regulation of environmental performance has clearly been a catastrophic failure. That after 10, 12 years of naming and shaming, they managed to produce their worst set of results ever. That's an extraordinary thing to have achieved.
Yeah. I mean, the Environment Agency talked really tough about it, didn't they? They said they wanted to flog the bosses and exile them to prison ships or something like that, but maybe not that strong. But they talked about jail terms and tougher fines. But I mean, it feels like, I mean, are they just hoping that we'll forget that they're kind of responsible for keeping them in line and protecting rivers?
Well, it's not only that they're hoping that we'll kind of forget. It again just exposes, I'm afraid, more of the Environment Agency's incompetence. Because maybe they haven't noticed that for 30 years, they've had the power and authority to issue any water company in the country with an enforcement notice and demand that every water in the company in the country does exactly what they do to a certain specification at a specific point in time. So they have complete and utter flexibility. We want you to stop dumping sewage into your rivers, or they can go down into the kind of granular detail of, we want you to do this on this sewage works by that date, on next sewage works by that date. They have that kind of enforcement power available to them. And they also have the power to fine any company not complying with that enforcement order, anything up to 10% of their annual turnover. So they could have been issuing these things on an annual basis for the last 30 years and fining those companies 10% of their annual turnover every single year for the last 30 years. To give you a practical context of that, they could have been fining someone like Southern Water £90 million a year every single year for the last 30 years. Might that have done something to sharpen the board and the senior management's approach and sensitivity towards what they're doing? So the Environment Agency's always had the power and ability to do an immense amount. I take the thing about making directors personally liable. It's only because I get really quite anal about this stuff, Rachel. Maybe the chair of the Environment Agency hadn't been briefed on Section 172 of the Companies Act that make company directors personally and individually liable, for they now, since 2006, have to have due regard to not only the health and well-being of the company, but also the company's impact on the environment. So when was the last time they've made any attempt to hold a statutory power that company directors have been under since 2006 and hold them personally liable and accountable under what decisions and what decisions they've made on an annual basis to ensure that their companies were not having a negative or subsequent impact on the environment? Well, doesn't look like they even know that power exists.
Yeah, because so there have been a few new rules put in place and in the Environment Act, and I think there are plans to do so under, you know, for future legislation. But, you know, some people say that they don't go far enough and they're not aren't quantifiable targets and stuff. What do you think about what's been done? So, you know, DEFRA and the Environment Agency trying to show that their action is being taken to reduce sewage spills from CSOs.
The simple truth is the Environment Act 2021 is a complete fudge. Mm-hmm. It's complete smokescreens, complete mirrors. If anybody hasn't figured this out yet, you yourself wrote yesterday about, 17 of the 21 kind of annual targets have been quietly buried and sidelined. The simple truth of the matter is there was nothing on the existing legislation that has been on the face of the statute for decades that could enable all of this to be resolved and fixed some time ago. Mm-hmm. One of the other layers that this all exposes, and if your listeners haven't looked at it, I can highly recend it. Last June, Ofwat wrote to the water companies, specifically reminding them of their statutory legal obligations under Section 94 of the Water Industries Act. And that in English basically says water companies have a legal obligation to build, operate and maintain sewage systems capable of effectively dealing with all of the contents of those sewers.
Yeah.
So what the law says is it doesn't matter what's in there. It doesn't matter whether it's road runoff or rain or sewage or anything else. You have a legal obligation to build, operate and maintain sewage systems capable of dealing with the contents of those sewers. They then doubled up in November last year and sent a second letter where the Ofwat is now trying to argue that the 5-yearly settlements for the last 30 years have included all of the funding the companies needed to meet their obligations, including Section 94 of the Water Industries Act. So the regulator's now trying to argue not only do you have a legal obligation to build and operate sewage systems capable of doing the job, we're now telling you as the regulator, we've given you all of the funding you needed for the last 30 years to do that job. And apparently water companies also have to certify to the regulator once a year that they have all of the funding necessary, all of the resources, the manpower and the systems to do that job. So they've got the legal obligation, they've got the money, they've confirmed they've had the people, the resources and the systems to do it. They clearly haven't been doing it. Question then becomes, what happened to the money? And I suspect we're now beginning to look at potentially hundreds of millions, if not billions, of bill payers' money, which has been handed over to the water companies to be invested into their sewage systems, their infrastructure, that has now vanished and gone someplace else. And maybe is that what the EA were referring to as widespread non-compliance?
Yeah. So, I mean, this has all been in place for so long, as you say, and people have been pointing it out. So what's the response of people that, such as, you know, I don't know, DEFRA ministers or the Environment Agency or Ofwat, when people put this to them? I mean, I've been trying to interview, you know, people from DEFRA and the Environment Agency at the top for a while, but they have politely declined. But, you know, so what, you know, what are they saying when this is levelled at them?
The truth is, what's actually been sitting in behind this since day one, if we're being brutally honest about it, has been political decisions about the price of water. And that has been the driving factor behind this for decades. And that's why the statutory guidance and enforcement guidance from DEFRA to the EA and to Ofwat has been so opaque and placid and so indifferent. And indeed, for me, that's still to this day sitting behind and what provides the foundation and the skeleton to the Environment Act 2021 is the dead hand of the Treasury sitting in the background going, well, you can do whatever you like, but you're not putting a penny on the price of water. And that's why DEFRA has come up with this idea of, oh, let's create process. Classic, classic old bureaucratic Whitehall ghetto clause. No better way of dealing with a problem than let's make it go away. Let's create a process that's going to run until 2050 when I can't even remember, Rachel, you know better than I, some of those ridiculous reduction targets, you know, on the River Wye or whatever. Oh, we're going to reduce phosphate by 40% by 2040 or something. River's dead in the next 3 years. It hasn't got another 15-20 years for you to reduce it by 40%. It's being killed as we speak. And by the way, in 10 years time, nobody will remember what the hell that target was and why they were all doing it in the first place. And as we've seen, DEFRA in its current incarnation is only too adept at just quietly burying all kinds of targets and pretending they never existed. You're all being played. I hate to say it.
Yeah, I know. I see it over and over again. There's new targets being put in place and, you know, for 10, 15 years on. And, you know, it's a completely different administration by that time. And they know that and they can all relax. And also, and even the directors of the water companies, they don't hang around for very long. They're there for, you know, 3 or 4 years and they pick up massive paychecks and then they're off. And they always have that kind of Saturday boy excuse of, well, don't ask me. It wasn't, you know, all this stuff that's happened. I'm new. You can't, you know, you can't level all this stuff at me. And then they go and there's another one.
It is why I become kind of fairly unsympathetic when it comes to the lack of political leadership. And that ultimately is what this is lacking. And that's the first vacuum that gets created. If anybody thinks for 1 second, I frequently tend to be a visual thinker. And in this particular instance, I've always found myself sitting thinking, under what set of circumstances could I imagine George Eustace, the Secretary of State for the Environment, charging into Downing Street, throwing around the furniture around the office, screaming and shouting, demanding that number 10 gets on the phone to the Treasury and gets the money and the budget and the clearances together to fix this. I have to tell you, it doesn't matter how much I've drunk on a Friday night, I've yet to be lucid enough that I can conjure up that event ever happening, ever.
I have to try a stronger drink. Yeah. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, swimmers get sick and surfers get sick and salmon stocks. Have you seen the latest report about salmon being in total and utter crisis because most of the salmon rivers are at risk or, you know, whatever the categorization is, but it's not good.
Yep. Well, again, it's one of the things that I know it's easy for me because I clearly make a habit of standing around up to my chest in water, waving very long bits of carbon fiber around my head, pretending that I'm going to catch a salmon any second now. The North Atlantic salmon, particularly in terms of England, it is now, my normal explanation would be it's a breath away from the extinction list. Mm. It's now basically somebody's now writing its name faintly on the draft. Next extinct species list will be the Atlantic salmon in England. And that is a completely scandalous situation that we've allowed it to get this far.
Yeah.
The bit that gives me hope in all of this, ironically enough, is now just the level of public perception and awareness of all of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I did speak at a town hall meeting in Maldon in Essex a couple of weeks back. And as I tried to explain to people, when it gets to the point when I personally have the likes of the Sunday Telegraph phoning me up to run profile pieces to give me a platform to talk about this, when I have people like the Daily Mail phoning me up and asking me to put together a 1,200-word comment piece, and when I have people like The Express, which I'll be doing later on today, putting together another 350 words on chalk streams, at that point it's over.
Mm.
You're now finished.
Mm.
Because when that cornerstone of Middle England is now getting so utterly outraged and disgusted and furiously angry about what's been going on, at that point, ladies and gentlemen, politically and publicly, it's now over. You're now in the end game.
Yeah.
So you now have a very simple choice for both government and the water industry. You can choose to cooperate and start doing the right thing, or you can continue to resist. But I can tell you from experience right now, to quote that old maxim, resistance from this point on is going to be futile, and you are losing, and you're going to lose this because the public are not prepared to accept that you are filling their local rivers full of sewage whilst basically making off with their contents of their bank accounts and the money that they've paid in good faith in terms of their water bills. It's over. Now do the right thing.
That is a great place to end it on a hopeful and optimistic point. But I completely agree. It is something that just a few years ago, hardly anybody was talking about, you know, outside of sort of environmental circles. And now it's regularly in the mainstream, as you just point out. And so, yeah, so it's a slow journey, but it's going in the right direction, right?
There's two quick examples I'll give you. I went with a bunch of friends last October, November to Southwold for a weekend. And one of my friends is a member of the House of Lords, very former high-ranking member of the Labour government, worked at Number 10, all that kind of stuff. He's simply Saturday night. He went to the bar to buy a round of drinks, came back and just went, "Sharky, that's incredible." What? Even a barman in a pub in Southwold was to my friend going, "Is that Fergal Sharky over there? Please tell him I think he's doing a fantastic job about the rivers and stuff. Absolutely love it."
Fantastic.
On a personal note, Rachel, as a musician, one of the most glorious things is when people randomly walk up to you in the street and want to talk to you about music and want to talk to you, if you're really lucky, about some small minor moment of influence you may have had in their lives or their musical education, and what a glorious, brilliant, beautiful, wonderful thing. My life has been transformed over the last couple of years. People have stopped wanting to talk to me about music. They now want to talk to me about sewage and rivers. That's it. It's over. You're beaten.
Yeah.
So my advice to government, to DEFRA, to water companies right now, we all know what the problem is. Over-abstraction of our chalk streams, water quality. Here's how you fix this. Publish a plan and strategy on how you're going to deal with both. We're quite empathetic people. We know it's not going to be solved overnight. We know it may take 10, 15, 20 years, but there's the two issues you've got to deal with. Cut out the bullshit, cut out all the process and the measuring. We've been doing that for 30 years. What's the plan? What's the strategy? We'll help you with that if you need it. Deliver that and we can all get on with our lives and look forward to a time when we can return fish populations salmon populations, and people could go swimming, kayaking, and paddling in England's rivers with pride, distinction in what we've all achieved, and a healthy, vibrant future ecosystems for generations to come. What a brilliant thing to achieve over the next 10 or 15 years.
What a brilliant thing to achieve. And let's hope that happens. Thank you so much for your time, Fergal. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, as always.
My delight.
And we'll be probably coming back to this issue again and again and again on the Eco Chamber, but I think this is probably the most articulate and succinct appraisal of the entire problem.
You flatter me.
I do, buddy.
And if you can find a way to insert it, big thank you to you personally, and indeed ENDS, for everything you guys have been doing over the last 3 years. Because let's face it, you guys were there shouting and screaming about this and trailblazing on it before most other people even knew there was a trail to be blazed. Well done to you guys.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I will definitely get that. Make sure that stays in. So thank you very much, and look forward to speaking to you next time.
Now it's time for Knowing Me, Knowing You. Simon Pixton and Alice Fillon are here to bring you the latest on green policy from Brussels. In this episode, they're going to talk about EU plans to move beyond GDP by publishing a range of environmental indicators. Over to you, Alice and Simon.
Thanks, Rachel. We're back with another edition of Knowing Me, Knowing EU. Are you ready to talk about the new environmental action plan, Simon?
I sure am, Alice. Yeah, I'm very excited.
Well, you and me both. The European Commission published last week its list of environmental indicators for the new environmental action plan, but they're framing the significance of the indicators a little bit differently this time around. Can you tell us why that's interesting, Simon?
I can see why you might be skeptical, Alice, but I think it is an interesting reflection of some of the trends happening at the moment in environmental policymaking, not just in the EU, I should say, but also to some extent in the UK and elsewhere. And basically, the European Commission has started talking about GDP and how we need to be moving beyond GDP. I mean, that's an exact direct quote, beyond GDP, which isn't to say that the European Commission is going, well, we need to suddenly stop talking about economic growth. What it's saying, though, is we need to complement GDP figures with other kinds of figures. And those include figures about the progress or relative lack of progress we're making on the environment.
So that means we're looking at a more holistic view of what wealth means for countries in the EU.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. And this whole conversation has been a few years in the making. What happens in the EU is that the EU adopts a kind of 10-year environmental plan, basically. I mean, you mentioned it already. Now we're onto our eighth environmental action plan, it's called. Was agreed last year between members of the European Parliament and the member states, so that's the EU governments. And the MEPs were pushing really hard to have a section about how we need to be moving beyond GDP and to be thinking about things more holistically. So that includes environment, but, you know, I think ideally it would be including a lot more social inequality factors and, you know, all kinds of things like that to basically give us a sense of the health of society more broadly.
Okay, and so the list of environmental indicators is an important part of that.
Sure. The Commission has basically said that ideally the list, it's come up with 26.
Yeah, 26
and
indicators.
And those 26 would at some point become part of a dashboard of socioeconomic environmental indicators that would give policymakers, members of the public, et cetera, a broad overview of where society's headed.
Okay, but that's quite a lot fewer indicators than previous action plans,
this is,
right?
So this is an interesting thing. So environmental indicators are themselves not new in the EU, and we've had them for a number of years.
Yeah, decades.
For decades. Mm-hmm. The last set of indicators from the seventh Environmental Action Plan was much more expansive. The European Commission this time around has deliberately restricted the number of indicators and said basically, well, we're using proxy indicator. So that is one indicator that's standing for the overall health of an ecosystem, for instance. So in the case of, say, air pollution, they're using the indicator, the proxy indicator of number of premature deaths caused by fine particulate matter pollution. So that's quite specific, but I think the thinking behind it is you can use this one indicator to basically reflect overall levels of air quality. As in, if PM2.5 fine particulate matter levels go down, you can reasonably assume that other pollutant levels, I mean, other pollutants also decreasing. So, you know, large particulate matter or nitrogen dioxide or sulfur dioxide or whatever.
So the reasoning here is you pick significant indicators rather than listing everything that we want to monitor.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that they've chosen to do is they're relying more heavily on indices. So an index on something called eco-innovation from EU governments, but SEEM is quite vague. If you look at the eco-innovation index, that's been going for a few years now, and that uses a bunch of different measurements and basically turns it into a kind of ranking of EU governments. So that's one of the new indicators, for instance. There's also ones that they haven't really figured out yet. They've got a kind of placeholder for environmental inequalities. The Commission doesn't yet know exactly what that's going to look like, but they've tasked the European Environment Agency, which is a EU agency, to basically come up with a measure of environmental inequality. And that will be one of them as well. So the Commission's kind of moving away from a super granular list of indicators, which isn't to say that those things aren't being measured anymore. They still are being measured. But when it comes to assessing environmental progress, it's going to be using broader definitions.
So for instance, the bathing water quality isn't in the list of indicators anymore.
Yeah.
Is there a risk that in a way we just don't want to confront the lack of progress on some of these indicators?
I did wonder as well when I was comparing whether, for instance, there's also nothing on noise pollution anymore. Mm. And there was in the 7th Environment Action Plan an indicator on noise pollution. The interesting thing as well is, of course, the EU is not doing very well on any of these indicators, really, or very few of them.
So the vaguer the indicators,
maybe the better.
The less we'll know.
I'm not sure. And I haven't had many people, many of the interest groups in Brussels, say anything specific about them. One of the waste groups did say they were a little bit unhappy by the waste indicators because it wasn't taking a specific enough approach. But because it's August, everyone's on holiday, so it's quite hard to know what the reaction is going to be to this.
So I guess it's kind of like, it's fairly easy to intuitively see what the problems might be. What might the benefits be to that sort of an approach? Is it, you know, I think there's been a desire to integrate it with other targets.
Exactly. I mean, it's definitely coming out of this drive towards having a whole range of factors that will complement our existing understanding of societal progress. I think there's always going to be trade-offs. So if you're simplifying, not everyone's going to be happy about these simplifications. I think the main thing to bear in mind, though, is that it doesn't mean that we're not going to be measuring this stuff. I mean, that stuff's still going to get measured.
And it's perhaps a bit more effective in taking a long-term view as well, because it fits in with all those well-being indicators.
Yeah, potentially. And I think the whole project will take a few years to come to fruition, because we're still, and the Commission will readily accept, we're still quite a long way away from having a kind of post-GDP dashboard of indicators. But I think they're really framing us as a step in that direction.
But basically, it's still under construction.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're interested in reading the list of indicators yourself, that's in the European Commission's communication 2022/357. Back to you, Rachel.
Thank you, Alice and Simon. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Eco Chamber. Thank you to Pippa Neal, Tess Colley, Simon Pickstone and Alice Fillon. If you're interested in hearing more about any of the stories we've been discussing, please go to energyreport.com, where there's an endless supply of articles, infographics, maps, interviews, past podcast episodes and more. And all this stuff goes back to the 70s. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and we'll see you next time.